Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining the National MS Society Maintaining Cognitive and Emotional Health While Unemployed conference call. Your moderator for today, Christina Forrester, will now begin.
Thank you, Chelsea. Good evening, everyone. As Chelsea mentioned, my name is Christina Forrester, and I am the Employment Services Manager at the Greater Delaware Valley Chapter of the National MS Society. I would like to welcome all of you to our first call of our 2014 Employment Teleconference Series, Maintaining Cognitive and Emotional Health While Unemployed. We'd like to start off by thanking Acorda for their sponsorship of this series. And also, I would like to introduce my hosts that are joining me on this call this evening, Steve Nissen, Senior Director of Employment Programs with the National Capital Chapter in Washington, D.C., and Barbara McKeon, Director of Employment Programs and Services at the New York City Southern New York Chapter. Please know that this evening's call will be recorded and available to you at the end of the series. Tonight's topic, maintaining cognitive and emotional health while unemployed, is such an important topic. The call is designed to provide you with tips to help you stay productive and maintain your health during times of unemployment. Tonight's presenters will share research studies and practical tips to demonstrate the importance of this topic, and clients will share their stories of how they have stayed cognitively and emotionally fit during their time of unemployment. After our speakers have completed their presentations, there will be time for your questions. Please jot down any questions you have during the call so you are prepared to ask them during the question and answer period. Be sure that you ask your question completely, as we will be muting your line once your question is asked, in order to allow us to get as many questions in as possible. We do our best to get all of your questions answered. However, due to time limitations, we may not be able to get to all of them, and we encourage you to call 1-800-344-4867 for more information. And I'll provide you with this number again after we hear from our presenters tonight. At the conclusion of tonight's call, we'll be polling the audience in an effort to evaluate the program. It's a short survey of only 6 questions. So if possible, please stay on the line until the conclusion of the program and answer the questions. We're always interested in hearing your feedback. Tonight, we have 3 speakers, Dr. Lauren Strober, Linda Elwell, and Chandra Books. Dr. Strober has a PhD and is a senior research scientist in the Neuropsychology and Neuroscience Laboratory at Kessler Foundation Research Center and assistant professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at the Rutgers State University of New Jersey, New Jersey Medical School. She is also a staff neuropsychologist at the Kessler Institute of Rehabilitation. Dr. Strober received her MS and PhD degrees from the Pennsylvania State University at University Park in clinical psychology. Dr. Strober has over 14 years of experience in MS research and has authored several peer-reviewed articles. She is presently funded by the National Institute of Health and the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. One of Dr. Strober's primary research interests consists of the phenomenological experience of secondary factors associated with MS and other neurological conditions such as depression, fatigue, sleep disturbance, and personality changes. As a clinical neuropsychologist, Dr. Strober's clinical interests are in the assessment of cognitive and psychological conditions following injury or illness and assisting her patients with the adjustment to such. Our second presenter, Linda Elwell, has a background in school counseling and prior to that career change was a contract administrator, drafting, negotiating, and interpreting business contracts. Until the end of February, she is working part-time for a nonprofit in Southern Jersey and is preparing for a spell of unemployment afterwards. Linda will share tips on how she stays cognitively and emotionally fit during her search for employment. And our final presenter will be Chandra Brooks, who was diagnosed with MS in 2002. Since that time of her diagnosis, she has used her free time to volunteer with chapter events for the National Capital Chapter and Central Virginia chapters of the MS Society, as well as participating in support groups. She is currently receiving Social Security disability benefits and will also share her experience of staying cognitively and emotionally fit during this time. At this point, I would like to turn the call over to Dr. Lauren Strober to do her presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Christina, and thank you, Stephen and Barbara, for having me give this presentation today. My research right now through the NIH is looking specifically at employment issues in MS and what are some of the causative factors that result in individuals feeling the need to leave the workforce. So one thing is doing research, but there is a really nice benefit when we actually get to speak to patients and really kind of bring this from the lab to reality, which is hopefully what we will do today. I've kind of broken down this talk into three sections, and for those of you who have a copy of the PowerPoint, it'd be easiest just to kind of go along with it. On that brief overview slide, part one is going to be speaking particularly about a lot of the research that I especially do, which is looking at the factors predictive of employment in MS. Part two will be looking at some of the outcomes associated with unemployment in MS, as well as in the general population. And then finally, part three, which is sort of the focus of today, is what you should know and need to know to stay active and assure a good quality of life if you're not working. So this is just sort of a great quote that I like to kind of use, and again, really guided a lot of the reason why I'm doing the research I do, is it's really important we know that unemployment is a grave issue in MS. And it's something where most people, the first people they go to, the first line about talking about even leaving work or feeling to go on disability is with their practitioners. And it's sort of our job to kind of help inform them about some of the knowledge we know so that they can make informed decisions with their patients. And that is a great quote from Johnson and Fraser that employment serves as a proxy for issues critical to patients' perceived quality of life and well-being. And MS clearly has an impact on employment. Physicians and others providing health care to people with MS should routinely ask about employment and support thoughtful decision-making about employment status. And we hope that the research that we're doing, too, at Kessler Foundation will help practitioners in making those informed decisions with their patients. So we're going to talk briefly about unemployment in MS, just so you understand what is sort of the current state of affairs and the problem. So we know that anywhere from 90 to 96% of individuals with MS are employed prior to their diagnosis. And this is particularly telling that, again, most people diagnosed with MS are between the ages of 20 and 50, and that's really sort of the prime of one's career. However, it's estimated that anywhere from 24 to 80% of individuals with MS become unemployed. And in general, based on the population and sample that they research at any given time, the best estimate we have is that only 40% of individuals with MS are employed. More striking, and I guess what makes me kind of do the work that I do, is that 70 to 80% of individuals with MS are unemployed within 5 years of diagnosis. And when we think about the adjustment to the illness, the progression of the illness, there's sort of this weird dichotomy where the illness isn't as bad as it may get, but yet the adjustment is. And so how can we help people in that critical time, especially when they're dealing with the diagnosis and their adjustment? We know that depression is greatest within the 3 to 5 years of diagnosis. So how do we help people get through that trying period and hopefully help them stay employed, as we'll see later, because some of the factors that are poor prognosis immediately following diagnosis can also exist following leaving your work. And then finally, there are several factors that account for an individual's decision to leave the workforce. And if you look at the model, for those of you who have the figure, if not, I will sort of try to make this a visual talk for you. We know at this point that there are certain demographics of an individual that will certainly predict, at least when we compare people who are working and people who are not, who these people are. And one thing is they're older. They tend to have less education. And sometimes that we try to think that that might be related to having a lower autonomy type job where they can't make as many accommodations possibly or have more flexible hours and things such as that, and female gender. So those are sort of the demographics that can predict or at least vary or differ between those who are working and those who are not. With regard to disease variables, certainly more often than not when we compare those people who are working and those who are not working, those who are not working are more likely to have a progressive course, and also greater disease severity as measured by things such as ambulation index, the EDSS scale, maybe brain atrophy and things such as that. What we're particularly interested in, and I will show you more particular findings about this, are the other factors above disease and demographics. And other disease variables that are related to the illness are things such as fatigue and cognition. And in particular, across the board on all studies, again, comparing those who are working and those who are not, individuals who are not are more likely to perform worse on measures of cognitive slowing or processing speed, which is the actual most sensitive marker to MS-related cognitive impairment, and some sort of degree of memory impairment. And fatigue, certainly, as we'll see in more detail later, is the greatest or largest culprit of people feeling that they need to leave work or that report more when they are not working. Some of the more studies that talk about the symptoms relating to leaving the workforce. Again, if we look on this one slide with the different studies, there was an initial study done by Nick LaRocca in 1985. These have been followed by other studies in 2003 and 2007, where Simmons, Tribe, McDonald followed people over some time to look at work entering or exiting the workforce. Fatigue is by far, particularly in the later studies, the number one reason for people saying that they needed to leave work. And that's somewhere around 70 to 79% of patients complaining of fatigue. The next after that tends to be things such as lower extremity physical problems, as well as upper extremity physical problems. And that's reported at anywhere from about 40 to 55% of the reason for why people felt they needed to leave. Following shortly after that is cognitive difficulties, anywhere from about 35 to 36%. And then balance or dizziness or heat sensitivity kind of come in shortly after, anywhere from 30 to 41. And so we kind of look at these tables and these studies and try to figure out, you know, again, where do we intervene? What can we do to help these? Because it looks as if anywhere from a third of patients who report leaving the workforce will attribute it to fatigue, physical problems, cognitive difficulties, balance or difficulties or dizziness, and heat sensitivity. In my own work, I asked a sample of 68 women about their current employment status, and of those, 27, so about 40%, reported leaving work in direct relationship to their MS. And then we asked them, well, what would you say contributed to this? And this is sort of an open-ended question that we later coded. And the reasons for leaving, again, number one was fatigue at 44%, followed by mobility difficulties, 41%, cognitive difficulties at 30%, and physical weakness at 26%. So again, anywhere from a third or higher report these four symptoms, which lay very nicely on studies that have been done in the past, which is a nice consistent finding that we know that these are what patients will say are the reasons for them feeling to leave the workforce. But the current research, so knowing sort of, and again, I should preface, all of these studies are done retrospective. It's usually done after people have left work. So it's a little bit more difficult to really understand what was the factors prospectively at the time of the decision to leave work. So that's one avenue of research we need to do. But more importantly, and a lot of my research, is that we know that demographics and the disease variables, such as the ones I just explained, they only account for 14 to 21% of the variance in predicting unemployment in MS. So that's less than a quarter of the picture can be explained by these symptoms. And we have, in fact, verified that there are these demographics, these disease variables, fatigue, and cognition that definitely predict who has left the workforce and who has remained employed. However, what we're more interested in and has been a thing of contention for some time is looking at the role of other person-specific factors that may also contribute to individuals leaving the workforce. And what we have found so far are things that contribute to employment in MS that have to do more with the individual than the disease or their demographics are things such as coping. So we know that individuals who are considering leaving the workforce or who have left tend to engage in more maladaptive coping styles, such as behavioral disengagement, mental disengagement, and even substance use. We also know that personality, pre-morbid personality, we are who we are. Some of these things kind of can predict many outcomes in even the healthy population. And in MS, greater levels of neuroticism and lower levels of extroversion have been a marker for those who are not working or considering leaving the workforce. Anxiety, so individuals tend to show greater trait anxiety and lower self-efficacy and lower locus of control for people who are not working or considering leaving. And then even more importantly, related to some of the self-efficacy and locus of control in general, is the feeling that one cannot manage or control one's illness. And if we think back, particularly to one of my first slides here, about why the rates are so high within the first 5 years of diagnosis, one can say that some of these factors may attribute to that, and certainly feeling that one cannot respond to the stress or manage one's illness could help, point someone in the direction of feeling that they need to leave the workforce or other activities in their life. So, moving on from this, and why is it so important that I kind of went over and identified and understand the causes of unemployment? And it's because the outcomes associated with being unemployed and the desire of so many to stay employed. So we need to kind of always say, how can we prevent this from happening? And we need to know the causes because we know of such important outcomes. So we're going to move to part two, and this part is the outcomes associated with employment status. Some of the consequences of unemployment in the general population is we know that it gravely impacts overall quality of life, and this is not just by mere financial concerns, which I think most people initially think of, but there are many other studies that show other markers of quality of life that do become worse over time when somebody becomes unemployed. But more importantly are these silent costs of unemployment that people don't see as clearly. For one is poor overall physical health, particularly cardiovascular disease. Many studies have shown that within 6 months of becoming unemployed, cardiovascular health becomes worse. And there are many other associated factors with that, which is why one of our studies, too, is we're trying to follow people over time after they leave to see if these detriments in health exist in MS as well. The other one is increased mental health problems. So certainly depression, anxiety, and sleep disturbance have all been found to occur in, again, the general population when people become unemployed. Very striking is that there's even an increased mortality. Again, that could be associated with some of this detriment in health and other mental health issues, and even a greater suicide rate. And if we think about MS, and we think that the suicide rate is already 7.5 times higher, we know that depression is common, we know that anxiety is common, we know that sleep disturbance and fatigue are common, it almost becomes an additive problem to individuals if they become unemployed and these symptoms get laid over what we already know exists in MS. Switching to sort of the positive side, there are many benefits of employment, and these relate also very well to MS in particular. One is that engagement in the workforce, particularly among women, results in increased confidence and self-esteem. And then individuals whose work is complex have been found to be more intellectually flexible. They take more personal responsibility. They have greater self-esteem. They engage in intellectually demanding leisure activities, which, again, we'll get to why that's so important in MS. And they're receptive to innovation and change. And when you look at these sort of descriptions and you think about somebody who's handling an illness such as MS, and you're thinking about things such as cognitive reserve, which we'll talk about later, it just shows, again, the importance of staying active, and if it happens to be in the workforce, even better, or even finding things that are similar to these activities, some sort of complex activity, because having self-esteem, being more innovative, being receptive, being intellectually flexible and open are all factors that we know have a better prognosis for individuals in general as well as individuals with MS. And then we know from many qualitative studies where they run focus groups and particularly asked individuals with MS what are their perceived benefits of employment and trying to get at is it the same as in the general population. And individuals with MS say that they view their work as important to things such as their identity, self-esteem, and their social contact, with many viewing it as therapeutic. And I kind of presented a few excerpts here that I really sort of think hit on the point. Again, these were focus groups where they just sort of asked people to speak openly about why they work, why they don't work, what do they think is beneficial when they do, what happens when they're not working. And one of the great quotes was, "I don't think about being tired when I'm at work. My mind is too busy to think about my legs hurting. That's the best reason why people should work. You forget about the MS. If I'm home, I get really depressed. Next one is, if I make myself get up and go, I feel better. Lying in bed and thinking about everything that's going wrong makes me feel worse. Another benefit of employment, and again, 40%, as I said, 40% of individuals at any given time with MS are unemployed, yet all the statistics show that 40% of those that are unemployed also report wanting to return to work. And most of them state that it's a way of being part of society. And there were two other quotes that I think really point to this as well. GH said, I want to do a good job and be valuable and worthwhile. No matter how hard you try, a lot of your self-esteem is based on your work. You have to realize that you need to be a part of society. And the other one that I thought really was pretty poignant is, if you lose your interaction with people, your world is going to shrink. So those are sort of some of a brief thing about the outcomes, the consequences, and the benefits of employment. And I hope that most people get the sense that the general gist is not even so much about it being the act of the employment. It's being involved in something. It's being around people. It's feeling as if there's a purpose or a meaning to your day, even just having a structure to your day, and feeling as if you're doing something worthwhile. For most of us, that tends to be employment. Usually when you meet somebody for the first time, somewhere in that conversation, you're asked, what do you do for a living? And it is definitely part of our identity, our self-esteem, our purpose in life. But when you can't work anymore, the question is, well, what can I do to make it so that I have those same facets? I have an identity, I have my self-esteem, I feel like I'm doing something meaningful and purpose, and I feel that I'm actively engaged in the world and with people. So that turns to our last section here, which is what to do if not working and the importance of staying active. And I'm going to preface this with, I was just at a conference where there were many posters and presentations on this exact topic, and I walked away saying it's the same thing we always say. Our doctors tell us, be active, stay active, diet, exercise. I'm going to tell you all the same exact thing. And we keep doing research, but we keep coming back to the same thing and saying that it's just important to diet, exercise, and stay cognitively active. So where do we know this from? In particular, most of this literature, believe it or not, started out in the elderly, which is a kind of point, though, to the downward track of how it's important when you're younger. So a lot of the research looking at mental and physical activity in the elderly, particularly this one prominent study in 2001, they compared individuals with Alzheimer's disease to individuals who did not have Alzheimer's. And those who did not have Alzheimer's were found to have engaged in more active pastimes, things such as knitting, reading, gardening, playing a musical instrument, or being involved in competitive sports during their 20s to 60s. Okay, so sort of the idea that what we do early on is predictive of later cognitive reserve or cognitive well-being or neurodegenerative degeneration. But that people who were doing things such as passive activities, such as watching television or talking on the phone, were found to actually have a 250% increased risk of developing Alzheimer's. And I should mention, too, this sample, the mean of the two groups, was only in about early to mid-70s when they were comparing this. But it pointed to this idea that if we're active when we're younger, it will kind of buffer in some way, and we'll get to this idea of cognitive reserve, it buffers in some way our risk of having dementia or other sort of cognitive disturbances. So we've sort of adopted this from the Alzheimer literature, and it's called cognitive reserve, and it's the idea that there are both heritable and genetic, clearly, factors, as well as environmental factors that contribute to one's, quote, reserve against disease-related cognitive decline. So clearly the genetic heritable factors are things where we've looked at are things like maximal lifetime brain growth. There's other just obviously clear genetics, which is not the focus of our talk today, but more so the environmental. And what that is really the intellectual enrichment. And that we know that higher intellectual enrichment reduces one's risk for dementia, and it moderates the effect of pathology on cognitive status. And I do think it's important to note, so cognitive reserve is not saying you don't get the illness. It basically says you can sustain more pathology, okay, such as, you know, Alzheimer's, before you start deteriorating cognitively. It's sort of, again, it's like having a more reserve in your tank. But in the end, these people may also get to a point where they have cognitively deteriorated, but they withstand more pathology before they get to that point. So researchers at Kessler have actually, in fact, shown that this occurs in MS. And this, again, was adopted from the aging or Alzheimer's literature. And they found that individuals with higher intellectual enrichment do have some protection from disease-related cognitive impairment. And what they do is, again, this is measured by many variables. Intellectual enrichment are things such as your education, your vocabulary, your occupational attainment, and your cognitive leisure activities. And I'm going to focus mostly on occupational attainment, obviously, and cognitive leisure activities today. So what they found, particularly with cognitive leisure activities, was that the cognitive things that they did in early life, so again, measuring people with MS now and asking them what they did in their teens and their 20s or early 30s, that was found to be related to intact cognitive status and ability to withstand more severe brain atrophy before or even without suffering any cognitive impairment. So they basically found that the same thing that exists in Alzheimer's can exist in MS, and that there is some sort of sense of cognitive reserve that occurs when you've been more cognitively active previously. So what are these cognitive leisure activities, and what do they even specifically measure? It's things such as reading books, reading magazines, producing art, things such as painting or poetry or songwriting, producing non-artistic writing, so people who keep a diary or write a newsletter or write blogs, playing a musical instrument, playing structured card games, crossword puzzles, board games such as that, and also finally participating in hobbies, gardening, model building, web design. And particularly, I will say, related to those last two, some of the research in Alzheimer's and stroke and just even elderly inpatients have looked at the effect of playing chess and gardening in particular, and those are really two activities that are both physically, well, especially the gardening, but they're physically and cognitively found to really produce some sort of protection or change in the brain, and kind of considered perhaps two of the most, I guess, if you're going to give the best boost of leisure activities, gardening and chess were up there. So something else to think about. The next avenue, again, so that's about staying cognitively active or healthy, but we also know about physical activity, and this is definitely found in MS. We know that aerobic fitness affects gray matter volume as well as white matter tract integrity. We also know that physical activity influences resting state functional connectivity in the hippocampus and the cortex. This is particularly important in the hippocampus, being that that is the region of the brain that serves memory. And so the idea that if we can keep those connections intact and vibrant and working as quickly as they could, it can possibly result in some sort of intact or improved memory. And so researchers at Kessler have actually shown this data with two participants. Again, this is extremely preliminary, but they have a grant looking at more. But they did find that aerobic exercise, just for 30 minutes a day, three times a week, for 12 weeks, resulted in increased hippocampal volume, increased hippocampal resting state functional connectivity, and improved performance, which is what we're really concerned about, on both verbal and nonverbal memory measures. So again, it's not just getting at the fact that the underlying brain mechanisms that we think of in memory were improved or increased, but that behaviorally these patients even showed improved performance on memory measures. And again, this is with very limited pilot data, but the hope is that they will find this more as the study moves forward.
Hey, Lauren, this is Christina. Sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to let you know, just so that we can get all of our speakers in, that we have about 3-4 more minutes,
okay.
So we have to move on.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
So the next part, just getting, this is sort of a broad general review on physical activity in MS. People have looked at not only just the cognition, but what else does physical activity improve? So one of the best things we looked at was fatigue. Again, there's inconsistent findings with this. But in general, fatigue certainly does not worsen from doing exercise, which I think some people think does happen, but it may improve reports of fatigue. With depression, again, the findings are inconsistent, but we do know that physical activity contributes to improved quality of life and that those who are more physically active also have greater self-efficacy, better functional capacity, which then results in greater perceived quality of life. So those are the cognitive physical activity. The last thing I'm going to talk about is the social aspect, which, again, we talked about with employment. We know that perceived level of social support is known to be one of the greatest predictors of depression in MS. Again, stated earlier, many individuals with MS stress the importance of social support as being one of the facets of employment that's most important. In general, women also perceive the socialization of their job as being even more important than the, quote, tasks of what they do. And we also know that individuals with MS who have supportive interactions report having a greater sense of purpose and less depression. So I'm going to skip over some of this and just go back to our last thing, finally, about preserving mental health and some of the outcomes associated with unemployment I spoke about earlier. So with depression, again, if you're out of work, it's really important to stay involved and maintain a good social support network. And again, assuring that you have some sense of purpose, meaning, and self-efficacy. Sleep, which again, it seems pretty obvious that people might start having sleep problems when they don't need to get up for work. It's important to really engage in good sleep hygiene behaviors in general, but particularly in being unemployed, you got to avoid the no work, no alarm tendency. So really, maybe for the first week if people do it, but after that, you really have to kind of say that you're going to get up at the same time every day and keep to the same sort of routine that you had. And we also know that physical exercise also helps with this. And then finally, fatigue, and I kind of revert right back to the sleep. We know that sleep, and I've actually done this research, sleep is one of the biggest predictors of fatigue in MS. So keeping up your sleep hygiene, making sure that you don't get into this tendency of sleeping in because you don't have to go to work, is really, really important. So in summary, I'm just going to leave a note. We know that employment is a significant proxy for quality of life in MS. It provides purpose and meaning, social support, self-confidence, self-efficacy, and overall well-being. And we know that unemployment is associated with many silent costs, such as poorer overall health, mental health issues, and mortality and suicide rate. And again, that the predictors of employment can be both disease-related as well as person-specific, and consideration of both of those are warranted when making determinations with your physicians or with your other healthcare providers or even your family when making such decisions. If you need to leave the workforce, it's important to maintain your health. This is both mental, cognitive, and physical. And make sure that you arrange for the engagement of these activities, volunteering, engaging in some sort of activity that provides some sense of meaning or purpose. And with that, my final take-home message, which I tell any patient, and it goes right back to that doctor always telling you got to diet and exercise, is use it or lose it. You know, our brain is just like anything else, and you always have to make sure that you're challenging yourself to use it every day. And that is it.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Strober. We really appreciate all the information that you have shared. And we are going to now turn it over to Linda, to take a couple minutes to share a little bit of how she uses some of these tips.
Yes. Hi, this is Linda speaking. A lot of the comments that Lauren made certainly describes me. The need, I see work very much tied to my identity. It is a very social aspect to my life. I'm the kind of person that sort of needs to be somewhere at a certain time. And that sort of ties to the whole productivity and emotional and cognitive background and environment that you're functioning in. I don't do well if I don't have to be somewhere at a certain time. Somebody is very good with open-ended time. I'm not. So what sort of that leads to is my need to sort of develop a schedule, not to be a slave to it, but it's just my nature to sort of know what lies ahead in my day. So what I've done in my unemployed stages is to kind of come up with an effort to make a schedule. If I'm at a point where I feel like I need to look for a job or I want to look for a job, maybe I'll make the effort in the morning for a couple of hours, send emails, do networking. I know that's, I sort of made my notes. I wrote networking and I wrote UGH after that because, you know, not everybody enjoys that, and sometimes you have to force yourself to do it. So doing emails, maybe doing career counseling so that you feel, so I feel that I accomplished something early in the day and I can sort of let things simmer for a while before I can sort of feel like I deserve to do something more pleasurable. But you do have to be able to say enough with the looking, phoning, networking. Don't obsess over it. So I have to really make an effort not to be that way. I also try to plan something that I can look forward to later in the day so that, again, I'm not obsessed with the working issue, either if you're looking for a job or if you're not working, but you sort of feel that you have to design a day that's productive, also includes some kind of pleasurable activity, whether it is going to the gym, if you're able to do physical activity within your limits. Lauren touched on that a lot. In the almost 30 years that I've had MS, the YMCA has definitely been my saving grace. Most of the time I've been able to do exercise, again, depending on how I feel. That's really been my sanctuary. And I tell them that at the Y all the time. It's been my escape. Physical therapy can also play that role, and that can actually help to combat sort of the laziness or the isolation that can come with MS and not working. The times that I've been at physical therapy, it really is almost can be like a Cheers, like a bar, like the Cheers show. Everybody kind of knows each other, and the jokes pass back and forth. And certainly, it's only somebody who has MS that can really, really understand and empathize with somebody else that has MS. So the times I've done physical therapy have really been helpful, both physically and also kind of socially, because people just really understand what you're going through. Something else, I'm sorry, my nose has gotten really, really stuffed in the time that we've sat here, so I'm sorry if I sound really hard to understand. Something else that really drives me, and again, who knows why this is, but I do feel the need to be productive, but I also could get pretty much of a real sloth-like attitude, be really lazy and sort of look forward to watching Ellen at 3 p.m. I have to make an effort to kind of circumvent that so that, I feel better if I get something done, whether it's, cooking something or cleaning out a closet. I also find that this can have a domino effect. And I don't know if other people have found this to be true, but, you clean out one drawer and it can kind of get you, moving about cleaning out another drawer or getting something else done or cooking something. So that tends to have kind of a positive domino effect. I was talking, also about providing yourself with a treat for the day. So if it's meeting with a friend who serves as a friend that's a positive interaction, somebody who truly listens if you want to talk or is just fun and relaxing, doesn't have any hidden agendas, there's nothing like, interacting with people. And I do agree, I think that tends to be a female thing, and that's why work has always been important to me. But keeping up with friends, having that sort of intellectual, interchange, whether it's a book group, whether it's a bunch of friends that get together and just, crack up for a while, humor is huge. If you can somehow fit that into your life or see the humor in things. Certainly in my time with MS, as unpleasant as it has been at times, there have also been some weird and funny moments. So to the extent you can build humor into your day, try to do that. Trying something new, doing something new, going somewhere that you say that I'd like to go, but I never have the time. Then when you have the time, you don't do it, whether it's because of lethargy or laziness or whatever. Do a list. I have the Constitution Center in Philly on my list. I still haven't gone. If you're able to kind of walk or, go into the woods, that always makes me feel better just to be in the woods. Try to do the things that give you pleasure and that you always say you don't have enough time for. And if you're unemployed, there may be no excuse. If, again, within reason, as long as you have the physical capacity to do that. looking at my last comment here, and I may have touched on this before, that, you know, if you're unemployed and you don't want to be, and you want to be employed, or if you're, you know, unemployed and kind of depressed or down on it, don't have the regret afterwards that you didn't use the time that you had in a positive way when you had that time. You know, if you have physical limitations, you can still go to the Constitution Center or the Philadelphia Museum of Art. There are ways to do things that might be a treat for you that, you know, you always may claim you don't have the time for. So I can go on and on, but I will stop there.
Great. Thank you so much, Linda, for sharing your experience. And lastly, we're going to hear from Shonda a little bit about her experience.
Okay, thank you. Well, as you said in my introduction, I was diagnosed back in 2002, and throughout these years of experience of dealing with the many facets of having MS, I do know that one thing that has really helped me to stay cognitively enabled was after my last really bad relapse, one thing my doctor told me to do was just to go out and volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And the first, I'm sorry?
I said, yep. I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah. And the first thing that I did was I called my local chapter, which is the D.C. chapter, and asked if they needed someone to help come in and do some things. And initially, I was doing some filing, and then it got as far as I was putting in things for transportation, updating the database. And because of the relapse that I had, I lost a lot of my cognitive ability. And through the process of me volunteering, all that did was kind of refresh those skills that were dormant. And in addition to the fact I got to work around a lot of great people, you know, not only the staffers, but those people who have MS as well. And because my mom's friend, his best friend has MS, that's how my parents and I got involved in the Central Virginia chapter, and we would go volunteer for their bike ride, and that was just so much fun. And they were like, yeah, so when are you guys coming again? And just being around a lot of people and just being involved and interacting with people who also had MS like myself, but other people who didn't, they would be able to see how to deal and to cope with people who have MS and how to actually confront them and be able to communicate and things like that. And I know I know one of the topics is how to, you know, deal as far as like cognitively and just staying motivated during the time that you're not working. In addition to me volunteering, I have found out that I'm kind of a workout nut. You know, I constantly work out doing the swim classes that the MS Society sponsors and doing my own independent working out, as well as I was doing a lot of reading, and I got into watching a lot of game shows and playing a lot of word games and things of that nature. And I didn't realize until later on that things like that actually helps your brain function and how your brain communicates. And it actually increase and help you to be able to think better and to cognitively process information better. And then you will be able to digest and be able to process things a lot better. So I think that's all that I can think of off the top of my head.
Great. Thank you so much, Sandra.
You're welcome.
Thank you, all three of you, for sharing all the information, the research, and the tips. It's all great information, and I hope the participants have found it useful. And we're going to open it up to question and answers now. So, Chelsea, if you could please come on for Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number one key. Our first question will come from Lucille. Lucille, please go ahead. Our next question will come from Sean. Sean, please go ahead.
Thank you. I was wondering if you're doing a hobby such as knitting, does it need to be a continually more complex pattern, more complex vocabulary in your reading, or can you do simple things?
You know, I don't know if anybody's looked at that directly, but certainly we think about, and not that, I mean, again, your brain is not really a muscle in that way, but certainly the same way that you could plateau in doing anything physically, you might be able to plateau cognitively as well. So certainly challenging, and I know, like, sometimes people will say, well, learn another language or pick up a different instrument. If you're already playing one, try transitioning it, you're transferring those skills to another instrument. So there is some component, probably, of challenging yourself, but I don't know if anybody's ever compared, like, complex activity versus monotonous activity or learned beat activity. But I personally would say challenging yourself for your brain to kind of think differently and to let other networks kind of get used is probably better off.
But this is Linda speaking. I think, you know, even, you know, the knitting or something that gives you pleasure is can have anything but a positive effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our next question comes from Deborah. Deborah, please go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just have a couple questions. Now, is it okay to disclose that you have MS on the job interview, or should I keep that mum? Because
Christina or Steve, Barb, do you guys want to maybe take that one? Because that sounds a little bit.
Yeah. Well, we have resources at each of our chapters that, you know, Steve and Barbara and I are all on the call, and disclosure is a huge topic. There's not one answer to fit all. So, you know, if you want to contact your chapter directly or get in contact with, I'll give you my email. It's msworks@nmss.org, and we can help you get an answer or work on an answer in that question for you.
Our next question comes from E. E, please go ahead.
Yes. When you are ready to go out on disability, do you have to not be working before you apply for Social Security disability? Or can you still maintain your work and apply?
Again, that is a question that's on one of our other teleconferences that's coming up. So if you want to check back with the series, and we can help you answer that question or contact your local chapter. We want to keep the questions to stay in cognitively and emotionally fit during unemployment tonight, please.
Our next question comes from Barbara. Barbara, please go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I had been out of work for quite a while raising my kids, and then I was starting to go back to work, taking some classes and things, and I was diagnosed. So I hadn't been in the workforce for quite a while before MS. My question is, what kind of job at this point, I mean, could I go for? Is there any kind of, like, website or anything that you could tell me that would enable me to find something that would be, you know, challenging but not overwhelming? I used to be a special ed teacher. I definitely can't do that now as far as getting on the floor with little kids and things. But, you know, I'd like to utilize my expertise in some way. Is there anything you'd recommend that?
So certainly, I feel, and Christina and Barbara and Steve, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. You know, if you ever go to your local chapter, I know it's certainly on ours, there's always a link for, there's an attorney as well as sort of job counselors that sort of help people get back into the workforce or talk about leaving the workforce. And those individuals, and a lot of them might even be vocational specialists or rehabilitation specialists, really know how to kind of assess where somebody is cognitively, physically, emotionally, and figure out what might be the best avenue to return to work, and how to even graduate that over time, if maybe it's a way of just entering back in, seeing what you're capable of. You know, some offices like the Office of OVR or DVR even have job coaches that help you kind of enter back in. So it might be helpful to contact your local MS chapter or certainly look on the newsletters. And I always see a link there because I always see it around my study at my chapter to contact somebody that's a specialist on employment in MS. And that might be the first avenue.
Yes, thank you, Lauren. That would be correct. I would encourage anybody that has specific questions about, you know, getting back into the workforce or what they could do, disclosure, all of those things, to you can call the 1-800 number, which is 800-344-4867, and they'll connect you to your local chapter. And then we can get you the answers there or have you connect with an employment specialist.
Our next question comes from Karen. Karen, please go ahead.
I just have more of a comment than a question. I would agree with everything that was said, and it just kind of validates staying active and volunteering. I was diagnosed 4 years ago when I had 10-month-old twins, and so that consumed a lot of my time raising them, but now I find being active in their school and volunteering with the multiples organization really does help me a lot.
This is Linda speaking. I think that that's a great example of how you can kind of cobble together a situation that's satisfactory to you. You know, you have little, you know, you must really have your hands full with the twins, but you know, getting involved through the society and also through the school. And that, you know, you never know what that will lead to in the future. So, I mean, that's a really great example of kind of cobbling together something that will kind of keep you, you know, busy and engaged. So I think that's great.
Our next question comes from Shaletta. Shaletta, please go ahead.
I have a question. My question is, I was diagnosed with MS back in 2002, I lost my vision, and the my balance was off. And then just this past year, I had a relapse, and now I'm using a cane as well as a walker. And I would like to wean myself off of both of these equipment that is provided for me. And I'm trying to find if there's any physical therapist that specializes in MS to help me to be rehabilitated to normal function, daily functions.
This is Christina. Again, you'll want to call your local chapter. You can call 800-344-4867, and your local chapter has a database that's going to have physical therapists, other kinds of doctors and whatnot in it, and they can give you local resources that would be helpful to you.
Our next question comes from Patricia. Patricia, please go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to assume that's me. I usually go by Patty, so excuse me. I guess my thing today is also more of a comment. When I got diagnosed, I wasn't out working. I got diagnosed right after I had my last child, who was now 9. But I ended up, I've actually had MS for 14 years. One of the things I have found helpful, as we've heard, is the volunteering, because I've still been volunteering. I've been a professional secretary for over 20 years, and I do miss the working. My ex-husband ended up taking my kids because of the MS is what he used. So in the meantime, I've been volunteering, which helps me deal with the MS as well. cognitively, I do see where the MS has messed with my brain a bit. Don't like it, but I've learned to accept what damage it has done. But I have found to not to give up, get up every day and continue. Rest when I need it. And knock on wood, I've had no relapses since I've been diagnosed. I've enjoyed listening to everybody tonight as well. I do thank you. And where I am at also, I'm also the local MS support group leader.
Thank you, Patty. Thank you for sharing. Chelsea, I think we can do one last question and then we'll conclude the call and do the polling question.
Okay, great. Our final question comes from Francis. Francis, please go ahead.
Yes, I was diagnosed back in around 2010. My question is, as far as the cognitive abilities, is there any kind of a standardized test to see if, you know, how you should measure up? And because I'm kind of getting older, too, and I'm wondering, you know, which is worse? Is it the aging or is it the MS or, you know, am I pretty much okay? But I don't know if there's a standardized test, but that's my question. Is there some way to gauge it?
Yes, there absolutely is. So you can always speak to your neurologist about getting a neuropsychological evaluation done. In particular, there's one battery. It's called the MACFIM. It's the Minimal Assessment of Cognition in MS. It's about a 90-minute battery, and we typically as neuropsychologists use that as a screening tool to know whether or not a larger battery needs to be done. But this gives us a really good idea. And again, in particular, the two domains of cognition that are most affected in MS, which is actually what, you know, even Shonda was mentioning earlier, is that processing speed. It's the firing of the nerves. It's the thinking speed of your brain and memory. Okay, those are the two most impacted domains. And so the MACFIMS gets at both of those in a very good way, and it's sort of used to let us know if you want to have a greater evaluation done to make determinations such as work or school or tracking the progression of the disease, that could be warranted, and that we would tell from the screening battery. So certainly talk to your neurologist if you're noticing cognitive changes, or even if you just want a baseline assessment like you're saying, you know, I want to know if this is MS, if this is aging, if it's a little bit of both, or do I look like any other guy that's my age with the same level of education? Because that's the metric that we can, all of our tests are standardized for things like gender, education, and age. So certainly talk to your neurologist about getting a neuropsychological evaluation.
Great. Thank you, Lauren, and thank you again to all the presenters. We want to thank all the participants for being on the call this evening. We hope that you have found this helpful. Again, any questions that you may have, you can call the 1-800-344-4867 number, and we will connect you with your local chapter. Chelsea, we can go ahead with the polling questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will begin our polling session. Our first polling question, are you currently working? For yes, press 1, and for no, press 2. One moment, please, while I prepare the next polling question. Our next polling question, how would you rate the speaker? For excellent, press 1. For good, press 2. For fair, press 3. And for poor, press 4. One moment, please, while I prepare the next polling question. Our next polling question, how would you rate the content of the program? For excellent, press 1. For good, press 2. For fair, press 3. And for poor,
press 4. Again, that question is, how would you rate the content of the program? For excellent, press 1. For good, press 2. For fair, press 3. And for poor, press 4. One moment, please, while I prepare the next polling question. Our next polling question. As a result of this teleconference, I learned at least one practical tip to help me maintain my health during times of unemployment. For strongly agree, press 1. For agree, press 2. For agree somewhat, press 3. For disagree, press 4. And for strongly disagree, press 5. Again, that question is, as a result of this teleconference, I learned at least one practical tip to help me maintain my health during times of employment. One moment, please, while I tally the results. Our next polling question. As a result of this teleconference, I gained clarification of the relationship between working and enhancing my quality of life. For strongly agree, press 1. For agree, press 2. For agree somewhat, press 3. For disagree, press 4. And for strongly disagree, press 5. Again, that question is, as a result of this teleconference, I gained clarification of the relationship between working and enhancing my quality of life. One moment, please, while I prepare the next polling question. Our final polling question is, as a result of this teleconference, I understand more clearly the importance of staying active during times of unemployment. For strongly agree, press 1. For agree, press 2. For agree somewhat, press 3. For disagree, press 4. And for strongly disagree, press 5. Again, that question is, as a result of this teleconference, I understand more clearly the importance of staying active during times of unemployment. One moment, please, while I save the polling results. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes our polling session. And this concludes our conference call. You may now all disconnect.